Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, we are back on the air after many, many days of the impeachment hearings, and it's nice to be back. But we were hoping that we would have the results from last night's Iowa caucus. We still do not. Just before 11 p.m. Pacific time last night, we learned that results would not be released until today. The Iowa Democratic Party is blaming the disaster on a coding issue with a new app. In 2016, Iowa caucus precinct captains called in their results. They used the phone. That's how they did it. But Iowa's Democratic Party decided to switch to a smartphone app to get faster results. And NPR had this story last month. In an interview with NPR, Troy Price, chairman of the Iowa State Party, quote, declined to provide more details about which company or companies designed the app or about what specific measures have been put in place to guarantee the system's security, end quote. NPR reports that cybersecurity experts they interviewed said the party's decision to withhold the technical details of the app does not do much to protect the system, and instead it makes it harder to have complete confidence in it. According to NPR, the Iowa Democratic Party expects results sometime today. They did have a paper backup this time for the very first time, but there are 1,700 caucus sites, so this could take a lot of time. Well, joining us to talk about the latest is John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation and host of Next Left, The Nation's podcast featuring interviews with progressive politicians. John Nichols is the author of many books, including The Genius of Impeachment. John watched it all go down in Iowa last night. He's joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, but he is just back from Iowa. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much. Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Center for Public Integrity, an independent investigative outlet focusing on money and politics, workers' rights, and other issues. And Dave joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dave. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Hey, a pleasure to be back.
Great to have you. So, John, since you just got back from Iowa, I want to start off with you. It's important to say that last time around, the precinct captains called in the results. They did it the old-fashioned way. They didn't have to wait on the phone for 2 hours like they did last night. Why did the Iowa Democratic Party decide to use an app? I mean, NPR reports that they wanted to get the results faster. Is there any other reason?
I anticipate that they were sincere in wanting to speed the process up. But that's a horrible reason, actually, if you screw everything up because you want to make it faster. And the reason they want to make it faster, of course, is to satisfy the TV networks, right? I mean, it's just, you know, kind of the standard model of a lot of our politics now, which is to subsume issues, ideas, relevant activities to a media moment. So I do anticipate there's some sincerity there. I know there's lots of people worrying about lots of other things going on and that all should be checked out.
Right.
But here's the bottom line, and the one thing that I think is so important here. It's not the app. It's the failure to test the app. It's the failure to take it seriously. It's the failure to respect what the Iowa caucuses are. Now, I think the Iowa caucuses are hugely problematic. I'm not the biggest fan of them. But Iowa fought hard to be the first in the nation. It got its concession. It then, as the party there, and really the state as a whole, committed to this. They got people at the grassroots to do the hard work of caucusing, which can take a couple hours. They do it mostly on a volunteer basis. They also got candidates to come. They got media, everybody. So they got the whole world paying attention to them. And they did not have the sense of basic responsibility, the sense of seriousness to test everything and make sure they got it right, and then to have fail-safe backups. They should lose their first-in-the-nation status because of this. They should never be allowed. People this irresponsible should never be allowed to have such a dominant role in a much broader small-D democratic process. I hope I'm not being too harsh here, but I think this is stunning. And I was you know, I was in Iowa for about, I've been back in and out of Iowa now since August with candidates, talking to people at the grassroots. Everybody took this thing seriously except the Iowa Democratic Party.
According to reports, this app was engineered in just the past 2 months. It was not tested at a statewide scale. It was sent to volunteers without much training on how to use it. It was not vetted by the DHS's cybersecurity agency. And now Nevada, we're just getting word from Nevada, according to Axios, that they said they will not use Iowa's app because they were going to. And John, there's a lot of information trickling in about who is actually behind this app. Do you have any information about the companies, the money that went into this, who actually designed it?
Sure. There's a lot of, kind of the moment information coming out. And there is a company that supposedly developed the app, with Shadow, and there are other companies supposedly tied to it, but they may just have been investors. What we're seeing right now is a huge, it wasn't me, coming from pretty much everybody who might be associated with this. And I would just say that beyond that, I don't know. I don't know beyond what's being reported, but I will say that this is an open invitation. In fact, I take away the word invitation. Let me say, this is an absolute call to duty for journalists and for people who have roles of responsibility in the Democratic Party to go to the very heart of this thing, to figure out who is responsible, to figure out who is invested in it, figure out if there was any troublesome influence or whatever. Again, I tend to be dubious in that regard. I think these people are just flat out incompetent. But we should figure it out. And we should also note one thing. This is a vendor, right? People that made this app. Well, the Democratic Party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has spent much of the last year saying they will punish vendors who support dissidents who challenge incumbents in primaries. They're all concerned about policing vendors and, you know, making sure that people who do things associated with the party, follow their line and obey what they're told. Well, maybe if they had, instead of doing stuff like that, actually focused a little bit of attention on making sure their vendors are competent, they would not have created what I will suggest to you will turn out to be one of the most embarrassing moments in American politics, and a moment that has dramatically benefited Donald Trump, because Donald Trump will make fun of this, and also a day that, because we know how media cycles work, a day in which a Democrat should have had the national platform, maybe two Democrats, maybe three, because sometimes it's high, if you finish ahead of expectations in Iowa, should have had the national platform to introduce a candidacy, to, highlight ideas. Instead, that day is lost, and tonight we'll have Donald Trump's State of the Union address, and the Iowa Democratic Party just handed Donald Trump a wonderful platform without much of a challenge.
Well, Dave, I'd like to get your thoughts on this app, because this was such a major, major disaster. I was surprised when NPR last month reported that the chair of the Iowa State Party declined to provide details about which company or companies designed the app. And the LA Times has a piece this morning, and I'll just read the headline to you. Tech firm started by Clinton campaign veterans is linked to Iowa caucus debacle. The LA Times reports that the firm behind the app reportedly is Shadow, an affiliate of Acronym, a Democratic nonprofit founded in 2017 to, quote, educate, inspire, register, mobilize voters. This is according to their website. Shadow started out as Groundbase, a tech developer co-founded by Gerard Namira and Krista Davis, who worked for the team on Clinton's campaign for the 2016 Democratic nomination. Now, I was watching all of this late last night, and people like Lee Fong, who's an investigative reporter for The Intercept, was saying that David Plouffe, a former Obama campaign manager, is affiliated with some of these companies. And so Chris Hayes on MSNBC asked David Plouffe about it, and he said, I'm just a volunteer. I don't know much about the app. So we're still trying to figure out Who is behind all of this? What are your thoughts on that, Dave? Do you have any more information you can share with us?
A couple here. And first of all, I think two things. On a very basic level is sort of the fundamental question I think most people who aren't clued into any of the technical or political particulars are asking, which is, well, why do we need an app in the first place? Why couldn't this have been done in more traditional ways that have generally worked in the past? Do you really need a Rube Goldberg machine to catch this mouse when a good old mousetrap will work? So that's a question I'm hearing a lot from people who are just kind of befuddled by all of this. The second issue is the one of transparency. And I think it's fair to say at this point, especially knowing now what we now know, is that this has been an extremely non-transparent process, that the creation of this app is one that is layered in multiple different firms and companies. You mentioned Shadow, which is the ostensible creator of this app. There is, in fact, as John had pointed out, a financial connection to Acronym, this Democratic nonprofit, which, to take a layer further, is actually an affiliate and a sister organization of a super PAC called Pacronym, which is also funded to an extreme degree by some Democratic mega donors, and is planning to spend well into the eight figures, I should rather say, on digital ads and other types of communications during the course of the presidential election this year. So when you take this all together on the whole, you have a situation where it's just not very conducive to people in Iowa trying to exercise their right to caucus to have any type of understanding at any intimate level, say nothing of even a relatively basic level, to understand why this is happening and why things got so colossally screwed up last night.
Exactly. And the LA Times reports that the state Democratic parties of Iowa and Nevada paid around $60,000 to Shadow. The LA Times also reports that among Shadow's clients is Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign, which paid $42,500 to the firm in July of 2019 for software rights and subscriptions. I mean, John, I think that the other horrible thing about this is it just feeds into the distrust that people have in the system. You know, I was seeing that all night on social media.
Yeah, it's huge. And it obviously, supporters of Bernie Sanders are very outspoken because they believe in it. It's a credible argument that it looks like Bernie Sanders will turn out as the winner in Iowa. Not for sure. We have to be very careful about that. But they released some data that seems to point in that direction. Frankly, a lot of complaints from backers of Andrew Yang, who, you know, did pretty well, you know, got a decent finish. And one of the things about Iowa is to get a decent finish, to get some numbers, and then you're heading straight into New Hampshire. And so a lot of social media frustration. And I have to tell you, you know, again, I tend to be usually in the camp that says it's incompetence rather than conspiracies. But I will just point out that in the last week, we've had a report that the Democratic National Committee, Democratic National Committee changed its debate rules to accommodate a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a political organization that had told young people who wanted a climate debate, no, we can't change the rules. Poverty activists said we want to debate on poverty and inequality. Nope, we can't change the rules. Cory Booker saying, you know, look, we've got a real problem here. We're not going to have diverse debates. Nope, we cannot change the rules. Billionaire comes along, they change the rules. Then we have a report roughly around the same time that the DNC, at least some members of the DNC, not the organization as a whole, but some members are looking at trying to bring back superdelegates because they want to thwart maybe not just Sanders, but also Elizabeth Warren, you know, dissidents, people trying to change the party. Then you have the Iowa Democratic Party completely screw up, dramatically screw up tabulation of the highest profile first in the nation contest. I think you're going to end up with a tremendous number of people, you know, putting all this together and saying, you know, this is a disaster. There's something bad going on here. Again, I tend toward incompetence and tenure and, you know, those arguments. But Democrats need to understand, and I don't think they do, how much damage they are doing to their own credibility.
Well, John,
at a time when they need that.
Since you brought up the Democrats changing the rules to allow Bloomberg to debate, I think it's really important to mention this. On MSNBC yesterday, John Heilman said that wealthy Democratic donors are almost more frightened of Bernie becoming the candidate than they were when Trump won. And he said he's hearing from people that if Biden doesn't do well, and you can tell us in a minute how he did last night, it sounds like he didn't do very well, that the moderates, the establishment are going to get behind Bloomberg. I mean, you know, this is based on what he's heard, but it sounds like, I mean, the Democratic establishment is very, very frightened of a Bernie Sanders candidate.
Well, you put a number of things on the table, all very important. First and foremost, it looks like, and again, we have to be very cautious about this. We'll get results eventually. The nice thing about the grassroots folks in Iowa is that they actually did do their job. They wrote the numbers down, they calculated, and so it's possible to put it all together and tabulate. But the indications that we have are that Biden did very badly. In fact, perhaps just a little bit better than Amy Klobuchar. And it looks like, again, with all cautions, like perhaps a fourth place finish in Iowa, which is disastrous. And so, yeah, you're going to have, going into the other part of your question, you're going to have this heightened concern on the part of the donors, the longtime staffers, the elites, or the establishment of the party, for lack of a better term, about the rise of dissidents, the rise of people who say that they don't just want to, you know, win the nomination. They want to change the party. They want to make it into something very different. They want to change the country and make it something very different. And you don't have to be some sort of, you know, reader of tea leaves to understand the motivations there, the desire to keep the Democratic Party as a centrist party, as a party that, you know, is at least reasonably sympathetic with neoliberalism and relatively comfortable with neoconservatism, at least in some cases. This is a real battle. It is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. It's playing out. It is incredibly intense. No one should be surprised that there will be push and pull. And that's, you know, the push and pull, the arguments are fair and reasonable in a political party. They should fight. Both parties should fight about who they're going to be when they grow up. But when you start to see a changing of rules in order to accommodate a new candidate, in the case, this case being Mike Bloomberg, this is where folks, again, you know, at the grassroots of the party, and frankly, folks in the media should be sending up alarm bells and saying, hold it, we have to look at this, we have to consider this, because this isn't just about the party, right? This is about our small-D democratic process. How much has it worked? What we know is that when the processes of political parties become warped, because of the dominance of the two-party system, that defines our November elections. And so this is a big deal far beyond internecine party struggles. And it always concerns me that so much of our media fails to cover it in that way, fails to recognize that a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party or a fight for the soul of the Republican Party is in many ways as big a deal as a fight for the soul of the country.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Center for Public Integrity. John will be with us for about 5 more minutes. So if you have any questions about what he saw in Iowa last night, give us a call now, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What do you think about what happened last night? Do you think it's time to end the Iowa caucus? Dave Leventhal, a total of about $50 million in ads was spent in Iowa. What really stands out for you when you look at that huge chunk of cash?
Digital ads do, and I think if there's been a major difference to technological options of it.
Dave, you know what? I think we have you on a bad line. You keep going in and out. Why don't we give you a call right back to try to fix that? Sorry about that.
Very good.
Thank you. John, what's again really awful about last night is it's overshadowing what happened on the ground. There are, obviously, like you said, a lot of calls to end the Iowa caucus because it is a place that is 90% white. I was searching for different kinds of stories on Twitter last night, and I saw things like, you know, first-time caucus goers of Burmese descent. And for example, Ash Carla tweeted, in a mostly Latino caucus with 185 voters, Bernie won 94% of the vote. So there were a lot of other stories coming out last night. Since you were there, what really stood out for you?
The young people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an astounding story. And you're, Rose, this is why you do such a good show. Because that's exactly where the action is. You had an incredible, you know, Iowa has a booming Muslim population, very substantial. And you had an incredible effort to make sure that members of the Muslim community could caucus and that it would work. And there were some really incredible stories there. You have the stories of the Latino community all over the state really mobilizing and engaging in some very exciting ways. The African-American community, long rooted in Des Moines, participating, very active. All of those stories should be told. They are a part of the Iowa story, although we can never lose sight of the fact that Iowa is a very white state, and that should be recognized. It should go into the discussions about whether Iowa should continue to be first in the nation. But it is true that we have multiracial, multiethnic participation. That was very exciting and encouraging in many ways. But the one thing that stood out to me was above and beyond these other good stories, was the youth participation. It appears that there was a dramatic increase in turnout among people under the age of 30. The entry polls tell us this. While overall turnout didn't increase much, in fact, it was relatively stable, young people way up. I was in a caucus in Dubuque. Dubuque's a traditional union town, relatively working class. This was a caucus in an area of town where there is a university, Loras College, and there is also a lot of working-class young families. The caucus was full, and it was so young. It was dramatically different than most of what you see in our politics. I went over to the Bernie Sanders section when people divided up within the caucus. I started talking to folks, and then I finally said to somebody, you know, how old are you? And she said, well, I'm 18. And I said, the person next to her, how old are you? And she said, 17. Because in Iowa, if you're 17, going to be old enough, you can do it. The next one, 18, 19, 20, 18, 18, 18. I mean, row after row of people in their teens who were participating. This is the dream of many activists, many organizers. They say, how, if you just get young people to vote, what a different country it would be. It was really happening in Iowa, and that's a great big story. And it's important to say that while Sanders was a driving force in that, Andrew Yang was really drawing a tremendous number of young people out. And they didn't always reach viability at the caucuses, but they had numbers. In fact, in the caucus I was at, in the first count, Andrew Yang was just one or two people below Joe Biden. So I just want to emphasize that, to me, that's an incredible story. And boy, when I talk to these young folks, and I did it both, I talked to a lot before the caucuses and then at the caucus I was at, these are people who are really thinking hard about where this country is going. And deep, serious, engaged. And that is a story that I'll keep trying to tell. I mean, I will write, once we get some results, I hope to write about it some. I want to look and see if you get a parallel reality in New Hampshire and other places. But that's a, you know, that's the reason why we should be so frustrated with these screw-ups, because the fact of the matter is that's a story we should be running up the flagpole and talking about, you know, 24/7, because it's something that hasn't happened enough in America and seems maybe to be happening.
Right. And then also, what message does this send those young people?
Oh, don't even get me started. I was talking to the young guy who was doing a lot of the organizing at the caucus in Dubuque at the end of the night. And he was very frustrated with many of the rules of the caucus and many of the structures of it. It's incredibly complicated. And the caucuses do not always reward hard work. And so as a result, There's a lot of there was a decent amount of frustration already, and then to have this meltdown, it is reprehensible, and it is deeply damaging, because we do struggle in this country to overcome disenchantment and disenfranchisement and disengagement. And at a moment when people are getting engaged, getting enfranchised, becoming a part of things, to then show them just massive incompetence and to foster a sense that perhaps it's more or worse than incompetence, Rose, you know me pretty well. I don't usually rant like this. I apologize, but I just think what happened there was, you know, the screw-up was just awful.
Mm. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be with you and with my colleague, who will offer wise and deep insights going forward.
Thank you, John. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and host of Next Left, The Nation's podcast featuring interviews with progressive politicians. Coming up after a break, we did reconnect with Dave Leventhal, and he'll join us for the rest of the hour. He's editor-at-large for the Center for Public Integrity, an independent investigative outlet focusing on money in politics, workers' rights, and other issues. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are happy to be back on the air after many days of the impeachment hearings. We are still waiting for results from last night's Iowa caucus. Just before about 11 p.m. Pacific time, we learned that the results would not be released until today. Again, the Iowa Democratic Party is blaming last night's disaster on a coding issue with the new app that they decided to use. They said that they did it because they wanted faster results. Now, they had a paper backup for the first time this year, but there are 1,700 caucus sites, so this will take a lot of time. If you have any questions or comments about this process, about the caucus, about what happened last night, what a way to start. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dave, just to stay on the caucus for a minute, I feel like every 4 years around this time, we all get kind of a caucus 101 and learn about this system. It's very, very complicated. But I think that in addition to talking about these first-time caucus goers, that there are people of color in Iowa, it's also important to note that a lot of people can't take part in this process because you have to arrive at about 7 p.m. and in this case, stay for a long night. NPR had a good piece this morning about how people who are living in poverty just can't take part because there's just too much going on and they can't make it. And then there are also reports about Iowa barring people who've got records, who are formally convicted of felonies, they cannot vote. That means 42,000 Iowans, including 10% of the state's black voting age population, could not caucus. So it's important to also point out those pieces of this story.
Without question. And I was not myself at the caucus last night, but I have been to previous caucuses. And, best, these are wacky, wild affairs where it's almost both expected and encouraged to
cajole and even bribe your neighbors to support your favorite candidates. I mean, I was there in 2008 and saw a homemade pie traded for snow shoveling between neighbors in order to get one person's vote. This is a non-democratic process, at least in the minds of some people who say, wait a second, why are we still doing this? Why isn't this a one-person, one-vote situation where you can go into a polling station, a polling place, you can cast your ballot, and your ballot is going to be worth ostensibly as much as anyone else's? But, Rose, you bring up a very good point, too, is that it is limited in an age in this, where we have more and more voting options, at least in certain states. You can vote by mail. You can early vote. You can vote at your local polling station on Election Day, but maybe you can go to a polling center in the days previous. This is something where you quite literally have to be available at one certain time, and you got to get to the middle school gym or the fire hall down the street. And if you're a working parent, if you just simply don't have the transportation to get there, if there is an obstacle or three or four or five in your way to caucusing, then the result may very well be that you are not going to be able to exercise your right as a Democratic or a Republican Party member to go and caucus in that state on caucus day. That has changed a little bit. There were caucuses outside of Iowa for the Iowa caucus for people who are from Iowa but are living elsewhere, including Washington, D.C. and Paris. But those are the exceptions to the rule that the Iowa caucuses and the handful of presidential caucuses still left in the United States, and there are fewer today than there used to be. These are just very, very different types of affairs than you would ever conceive of if you live in a state and have traditionally gone and voted in a place that has a standard presidential primary, or certainly a general election where there are no caucuses at all. It's a go vote and cast your ballot type affair.
What would it take to actually change the rules? If the Democrat, and who makes them? If the Democratic Party says, you know, we're going to stick with the Iowa caucus, but this is ridiculous. We need to allow people to just vote. Who decides this?
Well, this would first and foremost at the state level. So every state has a different approach to how it goes about their presidential picking a president. So that's why you have Iowa, which has its caucus, and a couple days later, New Hampshire, which is the first in the nation primary state, of course, that has a primary where you do go and you vote. You can even have different rules from state to state as to whether independents can vote in a primary, and in some cases can pick and choose whether you want to go into the Republican primary versus the Democratic primary. So it's not something where the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee can simply hand down some sort of national from Washington, D.C. type edict and dictate to the state how they're going to do it. But after this experience in Iowa, you better believe that there are going to be some calls from Democrats at very high levels for Iowa to change, and also too for Iowa to be reconsidered, or for the National Party to reconsider whether Iowa should in fact be the first in the nation caucus state, whether there shouldn't be some other type of system put in place. Those types of rules definitely do begin to fall more with the National Party than individually state by state. If you're talking about who goes first, what the rules are for what state comes after another. And we've seen in 2020 some states move up and move back, most notably coming up on Super Tuesday in about a month's time, when Texas and California, which both have huge, huge delegate counts, are going to be part of Super Tuesday. And whoever wins California and Texas, and there could be some, you know, definitely split delegates there too, but the person who comes out the winner could get a huge boost that they wouldn't have otherwise have gotten when those states took place, or their contests took place at a later date after Super Tuesday, when a whole lot had already been decided then and a lot of candidates had already dropped out.
And we should say, since you brought up the Super Tuesday in California, we've been trying to get the word out, and we're really only mentioning the Democrats because that's contested on the Republican side. There are a lot of people running for Republican for president, but it's really not contested. If you want to vote for a Democrat, and if you're a no party preference voter, you're going to have to request a crossover ballot, which could be a nightmare. Maybe they'll run out. Who knows? And if you're a Green Party, with the Green Party, you cannot vote for a Democrat. So what a lot of people are doing, and some say that they're holding their nose doing this, is they're registering as a Democrat, and then you can re-register back to no party preference or Green or any other party you're involved in. But the safest bet, really, if you're going to vote on March 3rd and you want to vote for a Democrat, is to just register as a Democrat. Otherwise, it could be a complete mess. So there's information online. Please share the information. Early voting has already started, so it's important to get the word out. And just quickly, Dave, since I've seen a lot of these campaigns online pressuring the DNC to stop with the Iowa caucus, what would happen then? What are some alternatives?
Well, you could have a number of alternatives. And look, we're in the heat of the moment right now. We haven't even gotten the results. We don't know who won Iowa or who placed second, third, fourth, or fifth. And as a result, passions are going to be running very high right now. There are going to be lots of calls for lots of different things. And really, that's not going to be decided probably until well in the future, sometime about 2 or 3 years from now. So, but it is going to be something that you can almost expect will be debated in some form or fashion at the Democratic National Convention as sort of the biggest national airing of grievances that will take place about this in a way where something different could be formalized. Could Iowa change its caucus system? Absolutely. And I think when you were describing how people can vote or not vote or change their party affiliation in California, that's a perfect example and one of 50 across the United States of how individual states will deal with their polling in a different way, state by state, from one to another. But also, too, at the same time, Iowa could do something very dramatic. They could get rid of their caucus. They could go to a primary system. Is that going to happen? Well, it seems relatively unlikely, but this could be a big enough screw-up where there are going to be major calls for reform on how the Iowa caucus actually gets conducted and whether it should be a caucus going forward. We have had states that used to be caucus states that are now primary states, so this is not without precedent, Rose.
We have a tweet from David who says, why does it matter if we had the Iowa results last night or if we get them tomorrow, and why should my opinion change based on what Iowans think?
And that's a great question. And I think back to, say, 2012 when, on the Republican side, Rick Santorum, he didn't initially win the Iowa caucus. The headline coming out that night and the next morning was that Rick Santorum had placed second. Ultimately, he edged out and became number one in Iowa about 2 weeks later. So this has happened before where there have been some screwy things and the winner of Iowa, the ultimate winner, was somebody different than who was announced on that night. But in the scheme of things, does it really matter from a delegate standpoint if the winner gets announced yesterday, last night, or today at 5 p.m. or whenever the results are ultimately going to come out? And we're hearing that at least some results are going to come out at 5 p.m. Eastern time today, 2 o'clock Pacific time. No, it's not going to make any difference. And there probably right now is actually a winner. We just simply don't know who it is. But the thing about Iowa, and the thing that has always been pretty true about Iowa, is that it's a momentum state. It's a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall delegate haul that you need to win the Democratic or the Republican nomination, but it's an indicator. It's something that says, okay, after these candidates have run and run and run for months and months and months, and as you mentioned, tens upon tens of millions of dollars have been poured into Iowa, but the people of Iowa have determined that Pete Buttigieg is number one over Elizabeth Warren, over Bernie Sanders, or maybe it's going to be the complete reverse. Does Joe Biden do well or not do well? It's an indicator, and one indicator out of many more states that's going to come, but an important one that can also oftentimes weed candidates out. It was Joe Biden himself who in 2008 ended his presidential campaign after a terrible, poor, awful, rotten showing in Iowa and decided that he just was not a viable candidate. We could have that from, for example, Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was really focusing on Iowa in a major way. And if she finishes fifth or sixth, that's going to be incredibly disappointing for her, particularly since she represents a state just north of Iowa. And she goes into New Hampshire without any momentum whatsoever. And I know a lot of people, their eyes roll back in their head when we talk about momentum, but it is important. And it's something that candidates need to have in order to raise money, to keep excitement, and at this stage to just do the basics, pay staff, get ads up on TV. If you don't have any energy, if you don't have any fuel, you're not going to be going too far in this presidential race.
Well, thanks for that important question, David. And thanks to Henry, who just sent us some breaking news from the Washington Post. The Iowa Democratic Party says it's going to release results of the caucuses today at 2 o'clock Pacific time. I'm just going to read this here. Let's see. Yeah, Iowa Caucus Live Update. State's Democratic Party says it will release results by 2 o'clock Pacific time. So we're not going to know until later this afternoon. You know, I was thinking about Dave's question about why this matters. And you think that in this small state that these candidates spent $50 million on advertising. I mean, every year we follow the money, Dave, and every year they break records.
They do, and don't expect that to change in 4 years from now. We're talking about the presidential race then. We're going to be saying, oh, yeah, 2020. It seemed like it was so big at the time, but look at it now. Now, there are two people, actually three, let's put it that way, who have really changed the game in a massive way. Two of them are on the Democratic side. One is Mike Bloomberg, and the other is Tom Steyer. And despite the Democratic National Committee rules for debates that encourage small-dollar donors, and despite there being an incredible number of small-dollar donors who have made $1, $5, $10, $20, $100 contributions to one or even multiple candidates, it shows that the system is still set up on the Democratic side where a Tom Steyer and a Mike Bloomberg, both of whom have virtually unlimited resources, can come in very, very late in the game and just start buying up ads hither and yon. Michael Bloomberg, he's pumped in more than $200 million in just the 3 months, and not even 3 months because he got in November. In 2019, when we were on the cusp of going into the caucus and primary season, and that superseded almost instantly the spending of all the other candidates individually. So it just shows that the system is, in fact, still open and geared toward billionaires who have those types of resources. And I mean, Michael Bloomberg was buying Super Bowl ads. He for a 30-second commercial, was able to spend in advertising dollars as much as some of the other Democratic presidential candidates have spent during their entire campaigns on advertising. So it's a remarkable number. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump did something on the day of his inauguration, on January 20th here in Washington, D.C., and that was file paperwork on the day of his inauguration to run for re-election in 2020. No president had ever done that before, where they had started the re-election campaign so early. And Donald Trump has had a huge advantage in the sense that he's been going around the country conducting campaign rallies and raising money like crazy toward his re-election bid. He was able to, of course, tamp down any opposition to him within the Republican Party. And he's going into 2020 in a position of certainly financial strength, where Donald Trump doesn't even have to spend any of his own money because he's getting it from everyone else. And this is a candidate who famously said back in 2015 that he didn't need anyone else's money. He would spend his own money on his presidential campaign. He quickly changed his mind, and it's entirely possible that Donald Trump won't spend a dime on his own presidential campaign here in 2020 because he's got so many other people who are willing to fork over money and support his campaign and help him win re-election in 2020, so they hope.
According to your group, the Center for Public Integrity, Trump has about $143 million already?
Oh, he's in fact raised more than that. This is just coming in very recent months, in the last fourth quarter, himself, his campaign. The Republican National Committee, which is basically a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump Politics Incorporated, if you will. And Donald Trump also has the advantage of having super PACs that support him. And these are groups that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for Donald Trump. Now, some Democratic candidates also have super PACs, and it remains to be seen what that structure is going to look like in terms of outside money and super PACs and nonprofit groups that are politically motivated and well-funded, what that looks like on the Democratic side. But that's in the offing, and for now, Donald Trump really has just an unprecedentedly strong and large network of political muscle that can really, really help him in a major way, blanket this country with any type of message he wants.
You know, it's sad, Dave, since we've covered this for so many years with you, is that I'm hearing people say, I don't like money in politics. These are the people that really want Trump to lose. They say, look, whatever it takes for the Democrat, if they've got to raise oodles and oodles of money, so be it, because that's where we are now. That's where we are now. So much money is being spent on these campaigns.
And, you know, we just a couple weeks ago marked the 10th anniversary of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision. And, you know, if I had a dollar for every person, especially among Democrats who I've talked to, said, oh, I just wish Citizens United would go away. The Center for Public Integrity, we commissioned a poll with the polling firm Ipsos to ask the very question, do you want Citizens United to go away, among other questions? And the vast majority of people, including conservatives and moderates, say nothing of liberals, don't like the Citizens United decision. But at the same time, too, I think what you're seeing in 2020 is at least a grudging willingness, if not a full embrace that, hey, whatever is legal is fair game for Republicans as well as Democrats, and that if the Democrats want to create every super PAC and raise money from corporations and in the millions of tens of millions of dollars, then if it means beating Donald Trump, then let's darn well do it. I hear that sentiment a lot. Now, plenty of people listening right now may fundamentally and vehemently disagree, but at the same time, too, that there are lots of Democrats out there who are willing to part with their philosophy and their ideology on the money and politics front if it ultimately means defeating Donald Trump. And that's a very odd position, and I think for people to be in, it's a strange situation for the country, I think it's fair to also say. And it's just the latest kind of evolution in the way that money and politics have worked in this country, in a very quick evolution in the past 10 years since the Citizens United decision just very fundamentally changed the way that money and politics mesh and intermingle and work in the system that we have in place. I don't think that if anyone was drawing the system up from the ground up and created a system of money and politics in this country anew, that it would look anything like the one that we have right now. But this is the one that we've got, and plenty of Democrats right now are very, very willing to work within that system to its strongest extent.
According to Public Citizen, Citizens United, 10 years later, 25 ultra-rich people have spent $1.4 billion on elections, and Republican casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam were by far the largest super PAC donors, contributing almost $300 million of all super PAC contributions. We'll do a show about this in the coming weeks. Today, we're joined by Dave Leventhal, editor at large for the Center for Public Integrity. And we're talking about what happened last night in Iowa. And then we're following the money. We've got just a couple more minutes. Let's take a few calls. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for covering such an important topic. I wanted to let your listeners know that there's a what's called a Bernie app, which allows people to, when they're talking with their friends, to write down, to type in whether or not a person happens to be listed as a Democrat or not, registered as a Democrat or not, and therefore they can meet the February 18th deadline in order to re-register as a Democrat to be able to vote in this primary, this March 3rd primary. There's also somebody on Twitter who I've been following. Her name's Jennifer Cohn, C-O-H-N, who basically shows the incredible frailty of the system, the electoral system, unless we go back to the nitty-gritty, the hand-marked paper ballots, mm-hmm. not the ones with barcodes, because nobody can read a barcode. It has to be readable to the persons who are doing any kind of recounts if necessary. And Jennifer Cohn is a very good contact, even though she puts more emphasis on the election security. She's got a lot of very good points in reference to the use of modems or Bluetooth, the dangerous use of modem and Bluetooth in being transferring any kind of results. She puts more emphasis on, you know, Russia interference and things like that. However, I go more towards what you just mentioned, the effects of our own homegrown influencers here, such as Adelson and what Greg Palast has been reporting on, the Koch brothers interference and stuff like that.
But thank you so much, Lisa. Sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. I actually have invited her to be on the show, so we'll keep doing that because she does really amazing work. And thank you. I completely forgot to mention that you have to change your registration here in California by February 18th. And I got an email from a no-party preference voter who said, wait a minute, we can vote in the Democratic primary. Yes, but you have to request a crossover ballot. And a lot of people think that that could be a nightmare. They might run out. People might not know it. If you vote from home, is the mail going to come on time? There's just all these questions. Just be safe. If you're going to vote for a Democrat, you just want to register Democrat just to be safe. But you've got to do it by February 18th. And you can find your status online. If you just search, check your voter registration status, you'll be taken to the California Elections website. Thank you so much for that important info, Lisa. And again, you've got to do it by February 18th. Dave, I know this is really not what you cover, but it's so important. We've done a lot of shows with security experts saying we've got to go back to paper ballots. In fact, Verified Voting put out a release this morning saying the situation with Iowa reveals the risks associated with technology. There are just so many risks. We've got to go back to the low-tech solutions of paper ballots.
And I've heard that call time and time again from a lot of people who are very concerned about this too. Is it going to happen nationwide? Highly unlikely. And one reason is because, again, we talked before about how primaries and caucuses many of the key decisions are made at the state level. Same thing with polling. Same thing with election, the act of conducting an election. This can be a very state-by-state and even county-by-county affair. And as a result, what is going to be happening in California could be very different than what happening in Colorado or New Jersey or Florida or anywhere else. So for there to be some sort of nationwide change to one system, be that paper ballots or anything else, that's not going to happen anytime soon. But definitely states individually can consider the merits of changing their system. And I think what you saw in Iowa, at least for the caucus system, was almost an extreme version of that, where this app that was created by a company that very few people were familiar with, which has curious financial ties to the Democratic machine as it is, was ultimately the thing that went wrong and had very, very little vetting, regardless of how you feel about it. So that is, as we talk about Russian influence and foreign infiltration, and mind you, there's no indication that that played a role in Iowa right now, but it's something, is almost as pedestrian but incredibly important as just a very untested or poorly executed piece of software that was the thing that caused the colossal screw-up that we're seeing right now in Iowa and continue to see and will for at least the next few hours, Rose.
Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Center for Public Integrity. Dave, thanks for your work and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.